Good evening, and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for November 16th, 2023. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Today's program is our annual look at underreported and suppressed news in the last year, which is highlighted annually at this time by Project Censored in their annual book, about to be published early next month, State of the Free Press 2024. Our guest is an annual pleasure to host here around this time of year, Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, where he coordinates the Campus Affiliates Program, a news media research network of several hundred students and faculty at two dozen colleges and universities across North America. His research and writing have been published in a variety of outlets, including Index on Censorship, In These Times, Yes Magazine, Media, Culture and Society, and the International Journal of Press Politics. He earned his PhD in sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, after a BA in sociology and anthropology at Haverford College. He's the co-author of the book, The Media and Me, and co-editor of the book we'll be discussing today, State of the Free Press 2024. So let's have a look at this year's news that didn't make the news and why. Andy Lee Roth, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's always a pleasure to join you and Annie on Corporations and Democracy.
I think we should probably start out. A lot of our listeners already know what Project Censored is, or they think they know, but you want to kind of give a description of what this amazing project is. It's practically in our neighborhood. It's over at Sonoma State, right?
Well, we started at Sonoma State back in 1976, and today we are, as Steve mentioned in his introduction of me, we are kind of decentralized and horizontally networked across a number of campuses in the United States and some years around the world. I see the project as having kind of two fundamental missions when it comes to news. First, on the critical side, we try to hold corporate news media to account when they fail to provide the public the kind of news and information we need to be informed and engaged in our communities, in our national politics, and as citizens of the world. And on the affirmative side, we celebrate the good work of independent news outlets and independent journalists when they provide the kinds of stories that we need that aren't being covered by their corporate counterparts. The other dimension of the project that I think runs back to its founding at Sonoma State by Carl Jensen in the 1970s and is true to this day is our emphasis on critical media literacy. Jensen didn't have that term at the time. That wasn't parlance, but Mickey Huff, the project's current director, and I often quip that Carl Jensen and his students at Sonoma State were doing critical media literacy before we had a term for it. We're very proud to have continued that tradition into the 21st century, doing hands-on training in critical media literacy with college and university students through the Media and Me book, students even in high school, and of course the general public. I think you have to be pretty siloed these days not to be aware of how important it is to be able to assess the trustworthiness of information, the trustworthiness of what is passed to us as news or journalism. And without the tools to do that, we're all disempowered as individuals and ultimately, I believe, disempowered in our ability to participate in the political process. So critical media literacy is, for Project Censored, one of the cornerstones of robust democratic self-government.
You just reminded me of a pleasant surprise, which I forgot to bring with me, actually, but it's the headline in the Ukiah Daily Journal, our local newspaper of record here in Mendocino County. And it was about media literacy to be taught in the school system, and it was the lead story just days ago here in the Ukiah Daily Journal. Some listeners surely saw that, but the visibility, the issue got what was a surprise, but again, a pleasant one to see in the headline of the local paper.
Now, I can't let you say that without saying that the Journal is owned by Media News Group, which owns the Marin Independent, the Mercury News, the Ukiah Standards, the Lake County Record Beam. Never mind.
Well, I want to give credit where it's due there.
It's good they're reporting it. It's also good to not take news of that sort as evidence that we can all crack open a beer and call it a day. Mm-hmm. There are ongoing battles when there is legislation to support media literacy education in schools. There are ongoing battles over whether that media literacy education will reflect corporate understandings of media literacy or the critical understandings of media literacy that Project Censored and allies of ours champion. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to herald that news and to celebrate the good decisions made by the legislators representing the people of California. But I think we have to remain ever vigilant to make sure that what that amounts to when we actually get inside classrooms is not a watered down media literacy that doesn't address issues of power. That's really the core distinction in my mind and what we emphasize in the media and me. The core distinction between kind of weak and strong versions of media literacy, do they examine power structures? Or as Annie just did a moment ago, do they examine patterns of ownership and how that shapes news content? Where the fundamental insight, I think, the fundamental question that I would ask as a critical media literacy educator is around ownership issues is, can we have a diversity of viewpoints when we lack a diversity of ownership? And you could extend that question and talk about, can we have a diversity of newsworthy perspectives when we lack diversity in the field of journalism and et cetera?
Well, that'll be a pretty important thing to watch with this media literacy law. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, it's good. You know, the other, I think, place where California is if not right on the forefront, they are leading the way. Along with the state of Illinois, California recently passed a ban on book bans in public schools and public libraries. Mm-hmm. And that's good news for people who believe in freedom of information. And as the American Library Association and National Coalition Against Censorship describe it, the right to read. So both Illinois and now California have passed laws that basically say you can't ban books in public schools. Again, I don't want to be sound like a cheerleader here. Those laws will probably be subject to challenges. Mm-hmm. But they're steps in the right direction. They're steps that protect our rights to freedom of information and freedom of expression. And ultimately, you know, I think kind of core First Amendment values.
We're really lucky to have you. Andy Lee Roth is our guest, and we're talking about Project Censored, the sort of the news about the news, something that is just as important as the news itself. Project Censored is coming out with this year's list of the most suppressed, repressed, hidden stories that are really important for us to know about. And it's coming out on December 5th, right? This year's collection.
That's right. The book and also on our website will feature the top 25 stories on our website. So we're a little bit in the business of selling water by the riverside. There's more to the book than the top 25 story list. But that top 25 story list we consider so important that we are willing to give up some royalties on book sales to make sure those stories are more widely understood and appreciated.
Oh, yeah, there's way more than the 25 stories, which are phenomenal in themselves, you know, if it give us an understanding of what we should have been reading instead of what we did end up reading, all the junk food news, you call it. But one of the things about the book, it's a snappy little book, a couple hundred pages, and There's so many people that contribute to it. I couldn't believe it. You have the editors, you, yourself and Mickey Huff, but then student researchers and faculty evaluators and a couple more, contributors, journalists who were writing about journalism themselves. How many people worked on that book? It must be a lot.
Well, just chapter one, which is the top 25 chapter, that represents the collective efforts of several hundred students and faculty at the college and universities participating in the Project's Campus Affiliates Program. Now, not all those students' stories are in the book, but those several hundred students identified and vetted and summarized stories that are posted on the Project Censored website as validated independent news stories. So those are all up there now. You can have a look at the, we call them VINs for shorthand, validated independent news stories. You can have a look at the VINs and see if you can guess which among them will be featured in this year's top 25 list. And I guess we'll blow the cover of some of that because I know we're going to talk about a few of those stories during this show as well. That's just the first chapter. Mm-hmm. Then students also work with faculty in producing the Deja Vu News chapter, which looks back at what happened to previous censored stories. Mm-hmm. Students work also on the junk food news story. The junk food news chapter, chapter three. And then we have additional contributors, Robin Anderson, who many people know from her longtime work with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, writes the news abuse chapter. And then Misha Herakulis, who works with Project Censored, put together the Media Democracy in Action chapter, which is kind of the good news story, which has fantastic contributions from Maria Armudian and Olivia Guyoto, writing about Armenia and censorship there. Christine Immerin of the National Coalition Against Censorship. Jen Senko, who many people know from her fantastic documentary and book, The Brainwashing of My Dad, about Fox News. And Rebecca Vincent of Reporters Without Borders. And then Max Alvarez, who is the director of the Real News Network based in Baltimore, Maryland, gave us the final chapter, a kind of send-off, salutary send-off, talking about journalism and making media that empowers working people. So all told, and this doesn't even include a shout out to our colleagues at Seven Stories Press who help us publish and distribute the book. Really several, it's, you know, probably 300 people ultimately do the work to make this book what it is. So I'm very, very proud and honored and humbled to be part of that big, dynamic, diverse and outspoken team.
And this year's edition has a special dedication. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, we dedicated it's, you know, Steve and Annie, we're talking on exactly 5 months since the passing of Daniel Ellsberg, who I think needs no probably introduction to people on who listen to this show. But we dedicated the book to Daniel Ellsberg as a fearless and inspiring truth teller who advocated for peace, freedom of information, and civil courage. And it's a huge loss that he's no longer here, but I think his legacy lives on in powerful ways among so many of the people that we work with. I'll just shamelessly plug, about 10 years ago, Daniel Ellsberg gave us an article that he'd written called On Civil Courage and Its Punishments. And that article, the text of that article is in the 2014 yearbook, but it's also up on our, website. And interesting reflection. I think you don't have to read too far between the lines to see it being some about Daniel Ellsberg's own personal experience, Pentagon Papers whistleblower, of course, but also him thinking. I'm trained as a sociologist, and I I read that piece, and Daniel's thinking about, well, what kind of institutional support could we create to support more of what he calls civil courage, which he compares and contrasts with what he calls battlefield courage, and he teases out really important differences, while noting that there are all kinds of ways that we do develop people's battlefield courage, but that our society has far less infrastructure for supporting the development of people's civil courage. And without rehearsing the whole argument, as I say, it's up on the Project Censored website for anyone who wants to have a look. It's a very thoughtful piece about what kind of institutions and organizations and incentives we could create to encourage civil courage. We miss Daniel Ellsberg tremendously. I got to meet him at a conference at the University of San Francisco that Project Censored co-hosted about 10 years ago. And it was such an honor and inspiration to spend some time with him. So we miss him terribly, but I believe that his legacy is alive, and I'll be bold and say in good hands.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. When it was toward the end, he knew he was dying, he would be giving out this advice. Here he did this incredible thing of getting the Pentagon's papers out to the public that needed to know about it. And he would criticize himself, says, "Don't do what I did. Don't wait so long."
Nice.
One of the things that, Steve, did you want to say something?
Well, I just want to mention to listeners that there was a memorial held for him on October 22nd. It was mostly online, and you can view it after the fact. It is available at the website ellsberg.net, ellsberg.net.
One of the things that's in State of the Free Press 2024, the Project Censored book that's coming out next month, early next month, is the news about the news is the lack of news. You're talking about news deserts. Do you want to explain about what news deserts are?
Yeah. In the introduction to the book, Mickey Huff, the project's director, and I riff on the question of what would happen if journalism disappeared. And we don't think journalism has actually disappeared, but it's instructive to think about what might happen if it did. And part of where that takes us in the introduction to this year's book is a discussion of news deserts. For many Americans, news, or at least the local version of it, has disappeared. A 2022 Northwestern University study, the state of local news, determined that a fifth of all Americans, basically 70 million people, live in counties that are news deserts, which are defined as counties where there is either no local newspaper or there's only one local newspaper, which means the county is one local newspaper failure away from having no local news sources. And the author of that State of the Local News study articulated as well as I can the dangers that news deserts pose. So Penny Abernathy, the report's author, said news deserts contribute to, quoting, the malignant spread of misinformation and disinformation, political polarization, eroding trust in media, and a yawning digital and economic divide among citizens. So news deserts are clearly a thing we need to be concerned about. For anyone who's interested in learning more and maybe exploring, do you live in a news desert? There is a fantastic website that Abernathy actually helped to construct, hosted by the University of North Carolina, called the Expanding News Desert. And it's interactive. I was able to go on and figure out that the county where I live has four local newspapers. I was not aware of two of those, to be honest. So you can go to the Expanding News Desert website and learn more about your own county or other communities nearby, and see for yourself whether there are news deserts. It's a great online resource.
Can you say the website again, please?
Yeah, that's the website is called the Expanding News Desert. And it's the actual address is US News Deserts, all one word, .com. But if you do a internet search on the Expanding News Desert, you should find it.
Oh, that's really interesting. I can't wait to look at it. We have some newspapers here, but they are all owned by one big media conglomerate. And the the big city here, quote unquote, Ukiah. It has one paper, and mm-hmm. it now, I guess they publish like 6 days a week, not seven. And right. their staff is way, way down. So a lot of the coverage is actually taken from their Eureka newspaper, which is about stuff that's happening in a different county. Mm-hmm. And I did have one reporter tell me the other day that, he's having trouble, getting information from one public official because of the news desert, that he doesn't feel like people need to, aren't going to go look for the news, so he doesn't have to give it to you. But one thing that we do have, though, that we're lucky that some other places, according to your book, State of the Free Press, is that there are a lot of places, maybe a fifth of the U.S. that does have a news desert, along with a lack of internet alternatives if they don't have the connections.
Yeah, that's especially troubling, because a lot of people might say, oh, well, it doesn't matter if there's a local newspaper or not, because internet access, right? And so actually one of the features on this expanding news desert website is a feature focused on, is digital filling the void? And we know some about that. We know, first of all, that internet is often not affordable or reliable in economically struggling communities. So they are, in effect, doubly deprived. They are least likely to have a local newspaper, and also less likely to have affordable, reliable, high-speed digital service. And so that creates this kind of vacuum into which we know, and we've reported in past Censored Yearbook volumes about the kind of fake local news sites that swoop in to take advantage of the vacuum and to take advantage of people's need and desire for local news. So that's what's been referred to in the past as like pink slime journalism, which is another news and food metaphor. Pink slime originally was a term used to refer to meat that wasn't very meaty. I'm going to not be a good source in being able to recall from memory who it was who first coined that term to refer to journalism, but the idea is the same. It looks in format and appearance like news, but it's highly partisan and ideological, and when communities are deprived of trustworthy, reliable local news, oftentimes these pink slime, you know, journalism in quotes outlets come in to fill and take advantage of that void.
Huh, wow. I don't think we have pink slime exactly. There is a Bay Area company that proposes it's a local news things, but what they really do is they take stories off of the local internet newspapers, of which we have several, which is great. I think they've cropped up all over Mendocino County. We have the Mendocino Voice, Mendo Fever, Redheaded Black Belt, Danila Sands does up-to-date stuff that's happening, Mendocino Action News, and we have Al Punto. We have a Latino paper. So we do have some internet stuff, but there is this Bay Area company that says it's local news, but it's using stuff from the real local alternatives that have put themselves forward. A lot of them are one person operations. They work very hard, and they just I wouldn't say he's pink slime, but he is slime.
Yeah, these ones, the original reporting on this was appeared in the Lansing State Journal, a local newspaper out of Michigan, and was followed up by further reporting in the Columbia Journalism Review. And the two outlets that were the source of almost all of this pink slime journalism were known as Locality Labs and Metric Media. And actually, Steve Masick, one of my Project Censored colleagues and students of his, actually did an update on that story in the Deja Vu News chapter of the 2024 yearbook. One of the really interesting findings they dug up, and this is a heartening finding, I think, was a Stanford University study from earlier this year that looked at Americans' web browsing habits and found that there was actually scholarly language was there was a mismatch between the production and consumption of partisan pink slime reporting. A mismatch meaning most Americans weren't actually exposed to it. And the kicker on this, where we kind of maybe enjoy a jolly laugh for a moment, is that the few who were exposed to pink slime journalism paid little to no attention to it. And so I don't want to get complacent here by any means, but that suggests to me that some fundamental critical media literacy skills are in effect, right? Whether people would think of it as critical media literacy or not, they're looking at these partisan stories from outlets that mimic the appearance and the tone of a news outlet and seeing through them, which is encouraging.
Well, let me take a moment to remind listeners, we're speaking with Andy Lee Roth about the annual book that will be published on December 5th. It is the book from Project Censored, in this case titled Stay the Free Press 2024. It's this year's edition of the news that didn't make the news in over the last year, and the state of the free press in general, and the independent press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here is 895-2448. That's in area code 707, of course, 895-2448.
One of the ways that you explain how everything works that I get a kick out is your food metaphors. And this time in your new edition that's coming out on December 5th, you talk about news snacking. And what is news snacking?
This is the counterpart to news deserts in some ways. On one hand, we have people who have no access to local news. They live in a news desert. The flip side is people who have access to news but choose to not pay attention to news or to much news at all. And this is, I think, another way that journalism can, in effect, virtually disappear, right? It's irrelevant. People deem it as irrelevant to their lives. News snacking is a term that media critics use to refer to the idea that most people now don't attend to news as a conscious, dedicated activity, but they do so instead as a kind of intermittent, distracted activity. So you're flipping through your social media feed while you're waiting in line at the grocery store, and maybe you see some news stories. That's what people like Hector Harkotter, who's a German colleague of ours. Hector is the director of the German News Enlightenment Initiative, the project's German counterpart. And he talks about this. The quote we have from him in the book is, news is no longer received consciously, but rather consumed incidentally, like potato chips.
Potato chips. We have a call that we would like to take, if that's all right.
Hello, caller. You're live on the air. What's your name and from where are you calling?
It's Brian here from Book Trails.
Hello, Brian.
Hi, Annie and co. Yeah, I just want to give a shout out for the Willits Weekly.
Oh, yes.
Which is our weekly newspaper, and I think is excellent, actually. It's all local reporting and covers a whole range of, you know, local issues and what local residents think and announcements and, you know, I mean, a lot of good stuff, including reports on what's going on in Brooktrails Township and Willits, etc. So the Willits Weekly, so we're not completely starved of local newspapers, and I think that's particularly a good one. We used to have the Willits News, which no longer have, and quite frankly, Willits Weekly, I think, is much, much better than that ever was.
Yes, thank you for that. The old Willits News actually was part of this conglomerate that I was talking about before. It included the Ukiah Daily Journal, and I think people in Willits were sick of it, and they got together their own Willits Weekly, which is just full of things that are going on locally. So,
yeah, indeed. Well, when I moved out here in from England in 1995, and when we were founding Willits Economic Localization, which became known as Well, which is in its 20th year, I think. That was in 2004. And Willis News was excellent. We had a local reporter, I'm trying to think of her name now, who was extremely hot on good local news reporting. And she became a real champion for Willis economic localization. And you probably remember that, Annie. You know, we became the poster child for so many communities in the county and beyond, and abroad, actually. So, you know, that's part of the power. So Willis News at that time was excellent before I think it began to lose traction and eventually, what you say, taken over. So.
Hey, thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you for the reminder, and hats off to the Willis Wheatley.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate what your guest is talking about. Just one last thought. I'm going to be working with a series of educational establishments in Hawaii next year, and media literacy is extremely important, and particularly, and I'd wonder if your guests can talk about the impact of AI and technologies that could also be mimicking what appears to be, you know, authentic news, let's say. And the distinction between what's fake and what is real. I'd be appreciate if you could maybe talk on that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Super. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, you bet. Mm. Okay, I'll take it off the air now. Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So, Andy, do you have some words of wisdom about AI?
I'm chomping at the bit. Thank you for that call, Brian, and your observations. Media literacy isn't actually singular. When we talk about media literacy, we're talking about multiple literacies. So it includes, obviously, kind of literacy in the sense of the ability to read and process information in written form, but it's also visual literacy. And in The Media and Me, our book about critical media literacy for young people, we talk about algorithmic literacy, the idea that it's one thing to use Google to search for information, and another thing to understand how algorithms are shaping what Google returns in response to your search. And the same could be said for platforms like YouTube and Facebook and the like, because algorithms are so much part of our everyday life now, even if we're often unawares of them or experiencing them directly in ways that seem beneficial to us. So I have students who would say to me, you know, Andy, why would I be upset about algorithms? I love it that Netflix recommends cool shows to me, or that Spotify can so accurately anticipate the kind of music I might enjoy. And there's something to that. But there's also, you know, the backstage side that most people are not aware of. And so a colleague of mine, Avram Anderson, who is electronic resources librarian at Cal State University Northridge, we did a study a few years ago comparing Google News with the DuckDuckGo news algorithm, looking for content focused on LGBTQ people and issues. So both of these are news aggregators that you punch in a term and it will tell you what the most recent news stories of note are on that subject. And we found radically different content and radically different sources on the Google news algorithm as a result of the Google news algorithm and as a result of DuckDuckGo's algorithm. And this isn't to villainize Google and to laud DuckDuckGo, but just was one way that we could do a semi-controlled study of how these algorithms, using the same search terms in the same week, produce wildly different results. So without going into detail on these findings, which are in an article Avram and I published in the Index on Censorship called Queer Erasure, what we found was that the Google News algorithm regularly returns LGBTQ-themed stories from religious right, from conservative Christian organizations that you wouldn't normally even think of as news outlets. In a way that DuckDuckGo did not. And none of them neither engine did a very good job of returning results from dedicated news reporting organizations that actually focus on LGBTQ issues. In both cases, we found algorithms were basically minimizing or throttling that content, which is partly how we got to the title Queer Erasure when we published that research in the Index on Censorship.
We have a caller that's been waiting patiently, so hang on a moment. Hello, caller. You're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi. My name's Neil. I'm from Laytonville. And I wanted to thank Annie and Steve for the show. Was just hoping that your guest might be able to speak to a couple of independent news outlets that, you know, people that live in rural areas can access for accurate information. As Annie mentioned, we do have, you know, we've got Daniela Sands, we've got Redheaded Black Belt, we've got some local news that is researched pretty well, but it would be nice to have some unbiased California and also international news.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call.
When you say rural, the first place I think of, and this may not be exactly what you had in mind, Neil, but I think of High Country News, which covers the American West in an amazing way. The actual print issue of the magazine is beautiful in its production. But that beauty is matched by the quality of the reporting. The focus of High Country News, as the title suggests, is the American West. So, you know, it's not every day that you will find news articles about the role of lamprey in Native communities, but the High Country News will cover that kind of story. The High Country News is also doing a great job, I think, in terms of covering stories that would broadly fit under the umbrella of environmental racism. And in general, I think stories that fall off the radar of the major establishment news outlets in the country because they're all city-based.
Excellent. And is that available online or is it only a publication?
They have a print article, but also an online presence, yes. So they're well worth tracking. And I'm sure you know, Annie, Steve, and you too, Neil, may know sources that I'm not aware of, especially California-based ones. I always think of, I think High Country News is the first I would recommend, but that's not to exclude the possibility, the almost certainty that there are other great ones out there. Yeah.
Understood.
Let me add, if you...
Thank you very much.
If you like what you see, subscribe. Okay, and thanks
for
your call.
Thank you for the show.
Sure enough. Bye-bye. Can we do a little detour? And that is to a topic I want to make sure we cover tonight, and that is the topic of media bias in the conflict between Israel and Palestinians. What are you seeing different between corporate press coverage and independent coverage, et cetera? And also I want to mention the specific article, which is on your main page right now. That's projectcensored.org. That article is titled, How Big Media Facilitate Israeli War Crimes in Gaza.
Yeah. I'll just start there. That's an article by Robin Anderson, who for the past several years has authored the news abuse chapter in each of the censored yearbooks. And Robin is also has an even more recent piece on the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Fair website. I'll just quote one passage from Robin's article and then say a few more things about the enormous topic of media bias in the coverage of events in Gaza, not only since October 7th, but in the decades leading up to it. But here's one of Robin's insights from the article, How Big Media Facilitate Israeli War Crimes in Gaza. The Hamas attacks of October 7th were taken out of the context of ongoing violence, presented without cause and in narratives that see only Hamas violence and have rarely featured or condemned equivalent Israeli violence against Palestinians. Establishment media's one-sided pro-Israel coverage, established over many years, fed into the growing consensus that a major retaliation by Israel would be forthcoming. Early corporate news reporting seemed to confirm its inevitability, with almost no voices of reason or caution allowed to enter the militarized revenge frame coalescing around a major attack. So that's one way into the big question you pose here, Steve. I'm working on a piece right now, and one of the points that I'm making is that biased news coverage didn't create the inhumane conditions in Gaza or the violence that torments the residents of Gaza now, but that biased reporting indirectly perpetuates and multiplies the human suffering there. And I think that we could talk all night and not run out of examples or material to talk about instances of media bias in the coverage of Gaza. But one that I'm focusing on is a kind of a hallmark of corporate news coverage, which is a relentless focus on novel and dramatic events rather than long-term systemic issues. This is what the media critic Robert Hackett, who is one of Project Censored's judges, he had a book, co-authored book a few years ago called The Missing News, where he made the point that for corporate news media, the news is about what went wrong today, not what goes wrong every day. And I feel like that insight is so important and enlightening for understanding Gaza, where most Americans have no idea of what life in Gaza is like, because people in Gaza have essentially been rendered unpersons by the corporate media. And I'm using that term unpersons in a kind of advised way, drawing on George Orwell's language from his dystopian 1980 novel, 1984, right? Where unpersons were people who were disappeared from history by the totalitarian government that ran things in the world of 1984, the novel. Today, in the 21st century, I think media institutions have the same power, right? Although we're seeing, I think, mass demonstrations and popular sympathy churning in some ways in favor of Palestinians and beginning to question the kind of hegemonic control that Israel has exerted over media narratives, both in Israel and also in this country. Although we're seeing some shift there, I still think it's the case that it's very hard to generate sympathy for people living in Gaza when their lives are all but unknown to us as people living in the United States.
We should direct people to your radio show, Andy, Project Censored. I think the most recent radio show did feature that kind of poor news coverage going on with Gaza. And four things I noticed that you were saying on your show is a lack of historical context, repeating hearsay as fact, which we saw our president do, dehumanization of Palestinians, what you just mentioned. And of course, I'd like to see a lot more of the U.S. role explained in this mess. So Project Censored, people can listen to that on Tuesday at 4 a.m. on KZYX. Or if you would like a more convenient time, you can go to the Project Censored website and hear the whole show on that particular subject.
Yeah, and we've had, so in addition to Robin Anderson's recent article, Eleanor Goldfield, who co-hosts the Project Censored show, recently interviewed Nora Barrows-Friedman of the Electronic Intifada, and also Jackie Lookman, who talked about how media outlets are not talking about conditions in Gaza and the West Bank in the context of settler colonialism. So that's kind of a missing frame that would help make sense of some of the violence initiated by Hamas, which isn't to say to justify that violence or to condone it in any way, but to help make sense. As John Collins at The Weave News has written, Colonization is a violent process, and decolonization may be violent as well. And again, that's not to condone violence, but just to say that there is a long-term historical context that is often left out of media accounts, in which some of that violence, again, not to condone it, but to understand that there's a context for it. I've been remembering, digging back, Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting back in 2012 had this great observation. Let's see if I can get the quotation here, because I don't want to paraphrase it when his own version is so clear. Hart reminded readers back in 2012, take note of when reporters tell you the latest violence, quote, started. They're picking a starting point for a reason, right? And more recently, the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association has pointed out in their media resource guide for reporting on Palestine-Israel that terms such as unprovoked attack often ignore prior events. So part of critical media literacy is understanding events in their context. And when corporate news media provide us reporting of events without adequate historical or cultural context, violence always appears senseless and often results in ahistorical reversals of victim and victimizer.
We have a caller. Hello, caller. You're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from Greenfield Ranch. Mm-hmm. My question is, from my perspective, a lot of the times this Palestinian-Israeli issue has gone back a long time, seems to go back with the money, and following the money seems to, for me, end up at the military-industrial complex right back here in the United States. So how does the corporate media tie into that wealth? How do they tie into that media or to that wealth? Is it just through information from the Pentagon and Washington and where they get to sit during press conferences? And could you shed some light on that for us?
Yeah. I think one way that influence is manifest is through Israeli efforts, and I should be clear when I say Israeli efforts, I mean the state of Israel. Israel is a nation state. Israeli efforts to control the flow of information and perspective around events in Gaza and the West Bank. Alan McLeod of Mint Press News has done important reporting on this, including a piece from a few days ago called Propaganda Blitz. And there are multiple forces at work here, and I don't know that money is the most important of them in this case. But externally, we know, for instance, there is censorship in Israel. Israel has banned, I believe, Al Jazeera. So you can't listen to Al Jazeera news in Israel. We know during the height of two of the waves of Israel Defense Forces attacks in Gaza that the internet was completely shut down. And Project Censored has reported on internet shutdowns in previous yearbooks. And we know from Access Now, an organization that tracks internet shutdowns on a global basis, that internet shutdowns are often associated with atrocities. So the flow of information is cut off in and out of the area affected. The other thing that that Alan McLeod reports about in this propaganda blitz that was news to me is that a number of U.S.-based news outlets have fired people for speaking out about Palestine. So CNN fired anchor Mark Lamont Hill for calling for a pre-Palestine. Katie Halper, who worked for The Hill, was fired for calling Israel an apartheid state. The Associated Press dismissed Emily Wilder after it became known that she'd been a pro-Palestinian activist when she was in college. And McLeod documents a number of these. So There are multiple forces leading to the kind of throttling of information around this topic, which is why it's so important to have genuinely free and independent news outlets. So there's a huge topic there that I could probably speak about all night, and we still wouldn't get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, we only have 4 minutes left, so thank you for fitting that eloquent answer in. So we need to wrap up. I don't think we even got to talk about some of these amazing suppressed stories.
Yeah, do you want to mention a few titles?
We only have 3 minutes.
Well, just the titles.
Let's cherry pick one and do it quickly.
Yeah.
Which won't do it justice, but maybe it will whet people's appetite to look out for the story list when it comes out and look out for State of the Free Press when that book hits your local bookshop.
And apologies to the caller. I think we're going to go with our guest here. We might not be able to fit you in.
We don't have time for another call, alas.
I'll be very quick, though. One of our top stories this year, I won't tell you how top it is, but it's right up there, is how forever chemicals in our rainwater are threatening global health. And this is based on a study published by environmental researchers from Stockholm University, who have concluded that widespread chemical contamination from hazardous industrial processes is rendering rainwater no longer safe to drink anywhere on Earth. The study was reported in 2022 by Insider, which many people still know by its old name, Business Insider. Mm-hmm. And the researchers found that PFAS chemicals, the per- and polyfluoral alkali substances, are not only in rainwater, but surface water and soil at levels that often exceed the strictest international guidelines. And that story, as amazing as it is in national and international implications, is one that when we researched it, to our surprise and I suppose dismay, has received little to no corporate news coverage.
Amazing. No more clean water and no coverage of that. Except for you. Thank you.
Yes, to Andy Lee Roth and Project Censored, coming out with their annual book. It'll be the State of the Free Press 2024, available from Seven Stories Press, beginning on December 5th.
You can get it right off of the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org, I believe.
Yes, projectcensored.org.
Yeah, and you can even actually pre-order it from now, and we may be able to get you a copy before December 5th.
Aha!
A little secret inside information for listeners of Corporations and Democracy.
Super. Right. Well, thanks for being our guest. Thanks for taking calls. And to that one caller that was online a minute ago, call right after the top of the hour, and you can ask a question, and we'll have a talk, but it'll be offline. But at least you can talk to our guest. Thanks for being our guest. You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy. We're on third Thursdays here from 7 to 8 p.m. The next edition will be December 21st. For further information about these kinds of issues, have a look at thealliancefordemocracy.org. Thanks for listening.